It's always nice with the Miller Center Forum to welcome one of the university's own back to the fold. That really isn't necessary with Bob Garl, but because he's kept in touch, among other things, with the athletic program over the years. But perhaps some of you didn't know that he was an Eccles Scholar at the university. He was Phi Beta Kappa, graduated in 1977, then went for 2 years to the Fort Myers, Florida News Press as a staff artist. After that, 3 years in Charlotte, North Carolina with the News as an editorial cartoonist. And then in 1983 became a member of the Richmond News Leader staff. He does 5 political cartoons on national, state, and local affairs every week. And these cartoons appear on the editorial page, which if you can't get the front page, as Al Fernbach was talking about, it must be a good second best. In the old days, apparently, cartoonist Professor Fernbach was telling us, and a few papers were allowed to print their cartoons on the front page. His cartoons are distributed by the North American Syndicate to 800 papers around the country.
200
papers. Not that good.
Wait a minute. I read 300 papers somewhere. Oh, I misread my notes.
It's going down.
Well, maybe we should stop at 300, which appears in print. My grandmother was an old Norwegian, and she, there's a phrase, der story, which means that it appeared in the newspaper, and she was she was sure that if anything ever appeared in print, it was true. And, so this was. He's also featured. His cartoons are featured in Time, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report, and his cartoons are a regular feature in the National Review. He's been the winner of 4 consecutive first place awards of the Virginia Press Association competition through 1987. He was cited for excellence by the Overseas Press Club, winning an award from them, and then again Dragon Slayer's editorial cartoon contest, winning the prize in that competition. He won the first place prize for the inaugural SBANE Small Business Cartoon Award, and if Robin Kuzin had been running the Pulitzer Prize in the proper way, why he should have won the Pulitzer. You all know Mrs. Kuzin administered the Pulitzer Prize competition for 13 years. So. But she knew all about him, so he must have been very near the top if he competed. Well, we're delighted. This is an innovation in 2 respects. It's for the Miller Center. It's political cartoons, but it also is a Saturday morning, and we're pleased that all of you would turn out in this way, and I hope we can continue to explore this area.
Well, thank you. First of all, I do want to thank y'all for showing up Saturday. I wish I'd have been able to make it during the week, but schedules just didn't permit. And I really do appreciate you showing up on a weekend like this. I've already apologized to a few of you in advance. I might sound a little bit incoherent or unfocused today. My wife and I are right in the middle of night feeding 4-week-old twins. So I might start to sound like George Bush answering debate questions. If I do, somebody just come up and slap me, and I'll be all right. I thought what we would do is actually keep this as loose as possible. I don't do real well in the lecture style of things. My job is to draw cartoons and make people react, create opinion, and try to rouse things up a little bit. If it suits y'all, what I'd like to do is basically go through a show and tell of some of my work, talk a little bit about what goes into cartooning, how I approach the job, maybe do a little doodling, and then leave a good bit of time for question and answers, and all through this, at any point at all, if you've got any questions or any comments, feel free to jump right in and ask them. Didn't even bother raising your hand. I guess every cartoonist working today has their own individual definition of what the job is about. I've never really settled on any one, and in fact, I guess every day I go in, that's what makes the job so entertaining. I don't quite know what I'm up to from day to day. It depends a lot on what's in the paper or what's not in the paper on any given morning. But I guess, broadly speaking, my function is to generate debate and generate some sort of discussion within the community at large about specific issues. I don't know whether any of y'all are real fans of editorial pages. I know that there are, those fans are becoming fewer and fewer and further between now. It used to be you could open up a newspaper and the editorial page had a real solid voice to it, I think. At least that's the impression I've been given by other people who've been in the business longer than myself. Nowadays, there's sort of a creeping USA Todayism, I guess you could call it, where you open up an opinion page and what you get is a happy face story about the weather or these dull, long tones which are more educational than polemical, telling you about some arcane subject that you don't really care about. I'm lucky enough not to tout the paper, but I'm lucky enough to work on a page where opinion still matters and where the idea behind our page is to make a point every single day of the week. And if people don't like it, that's fine. They're welcome to send in their own opinions and rebut us as best they can. But at least we're saying something and trying not to avoid hurting feelings. That's not our first intent. As a cartoonist, what I try to do is draw people into the page. I'm doing exactly what the columnists and editorialists are doing, only visually. Practically speaking, my day usually starts at about 6 o'clock in the morning when I get to the office. I work for a 10 a.m. deadline. So I'll arrive there about 6 and force feed myself whatever newspapers I can find. Usually it's the morning Richmond paper, the Times-Dispatch, the Washington Post editorial page, which is their front page, and their opinion page. I read the Wall Street Journal editorial page. I don't find that their news section does me too much good, but their editorial page is good for generating ideas. And even though I took a slap at them earlier, I looked through USA Today because they're a good index of what's going on in the popular culture. They've got a pretty good feel for what's happening out there in so-called middle America. By 7 o'clock, I'm pretty well committed to an idea, and that by that I mean I know what topic I want to work on for that day, what I want to say about the topic, and have come up with a general approach to it visually. By 7:30, I'm just throwing ink on the page and trying to beat the clock, so it gets kind of interesting when I start spilling coffee everywhere and whatnot. So at 10 a.m., my intense day is done, and the rest of the afternoon is garbaging in, doing more reading, talking with people, so I can generate more ideas for the next day. The best way to talk about cartoons is to do some show and tell. Y'all let me know if you can see these or not when they get up here. The most enjoyable part of my job, I think, creatively, is coming up with visual images and trying to approach topics in a kind of different or fun kind of way through your artwork. One of the most entertaining things for me is to try to apply animal characterizations to the world of politics. They fit very well, and ever since Aesop, for example, you've had animals used to convey all sorts of different ideas and personality. This is an old cartoon I did, I guess it's 1984, when Tip O'Neill was still Speaker of the House and Reagan was a little more active with his attempts at budget cutting. Is that coming out up there? And Tip O'Neill was, the hardest part about this was taking enough hair off Tip O'Neill to make him look like a sheepdog.
Reagan and I had problems with for a while. I sat there doodling, trying to figure out how to make Reagan look like a cat, or how to make a cat look like Reagan. And then it finally dawned on me that I could take this overhead projector and just put a tuft of hair on it, and it would be Ronald Reagan. So that solved that problem. I guess moving from the enjoyable part of cartooning to the least enjoyable is... least enjoyable is when you've been away for several weeks and you come home from vacation, come back to the office from vacation, and having been totally secluded from the news for a given point in time, and you open up a newspaper and it says nothing happened while you were gone. And you're just sitting there, you're cold anyway, you haven't been drawing for 2 or 3 weeks or whatever. And that happened to me a couple of years back. My wife and I had been to the beach. I got back to the office and I opened up the newspaper and the headline said, nothing happened while you were gone. And I read further and further and further, and by about 7:15 or 7:30, I was starting to panic, and I finally lit on two different things that had been going on while we were away during the summer. First one was Congress had been blasting a bunch of Reagan's programs out of the water. They'd been upping his budgets or whatever and cutting the feds and just generally walking all over him. It wasn't at his peak. And I looked at that and I said, well, whoop-de-doo, big news. What else is new? I mean, that goes on every day. That's the nature of Washington. And what else had been going on was that Reagan had apparently made the front pages with a little growth on his nose that had been cut off. Apparently that had been the big news story for weeks on stretch. So as the clock kept ticking on and on and on, and I got more and more panicked about deadline, I finally just went into a frenzy, and I made a little visual analogy of problem areas. And put that on the page. And I bring this cartoon up just to give you an indication of how silly the job is sometimes. Because here I was, I trudged up to the engraving department with this thing, totally defeated. I said, God, what a piece of junk this thing is. And it was published and ran, and by about 12:15 in the afternoon that day, but my phone was ringing off the hook. And I've never had so many people, and generally they were little ladies, little tiny little lady voices, sweet women. They called, Mr. Garland, I just want to tell you, the cartoon you had today was the most incisive piece of political commentary I've ever seen. And of course, being as honest as I am, I said, well, thank you very much. Because I spent weeks constructing that image. So just be careful when you're looking at these things. You know, we're all working under deadline pressure, and if you pay close attention, sometimes you can tell when we're really trying to get away with something cutesy and vacuous. Move on now to a little bit of the bulk of my work, which I brought, which is on the current campaign, which has been fun for cartoonists. You've had a lot of things going on. I guess the whole tone of this year's presidential campaign was set when Gary Hart dared reporters to follow him and find any dirt that they could on him, and they did. This is the result on Gary Hart outside of his Georgetown. That's about womanizing. How did that rumor start? Oh, that was kind of fun. Democrats seem to have a thing with water. You have Ted Kennedy and Chappaquiddick, Hart with the monkey business. Dukakis has got his Boston Harbor. It's kind of a strange string that runs through them all. I guess one of the more interesting aspects of this campaign was the Super Tuesday idea. The idea of, I guess it was fostered primarily by some of the Democrats who wanted to moderate their party's position for public consumption. Putting a lot of Southern primaries together in hopes that you get a moderate to come out of the process. It was actually, it turned out to be a big yawn. Nobody really cared about it. It sort of led itself to a long for the window tank. I think my ear went on everything. This is a fun campaign, but it was a tough campaign for cartoonists because you had so many candidates out there, particularly on the Democratic side, and a lot of them had these vanilla faces like Dick Gephardt. I mean, what the heck can you draw Dick Gephardt? He's kind of a blank slate there. And even if they have interesting faces like Simon and and others, Dukakis is even interesting. You can see in some of these cartoons, I'm sure, that how I, at least I was really groping early on. You've only got so much time to spend on each face, and you're wondering how to catch them. And generally, it takes a while for you to evolve your caricature. So you might see some sort of development and evolution as we go through this show and tell. Well, out of Super Tuesday, of course, the exact opposite of what had intended came to be, and that was instead of having a somewhat moderate Democrat jump to the forefront, an Al Gore or something like that, you had Michael Dukakis and Jesse Jackson skyrocket into the lead. For the Democratic Party, I suppose, this was a real uncomfortable spot to be in, because you're the party of civil rights, you're the party of the underdog, you're the party of equality, and here you've got Jesse Jackson, who's making at least the semblance of a real threat to grab your nomination out from under the nose. Jackson is one of the most eloquent stump speakers I've ever heard in my life. I disagree with everything he said, but at least he has the energy and the character and the personality to excite the American public. And Dukakis, of course, was just no match for that. So there was a real, for a few days, Jackson was getting a lot of press, and the Democrats were getting very uncomfortable, and they were put in the position of the father, and guess who's coming to dinner? Now the Democrats and his daughter the nomination. Now don't get me wrong, son, personally I've got nothing against folks of your persuasion. Well, of course, Jackson didn't get the nomination. I don't think he was ever a real threat to, honestly. Dukakis, though, had a problem at the convention in how to deal with Jackson and some of his demands, and that was probably the low point of the Dukakis campaign in a lot of ways, because he left Jackson out in the cold, didn't give him the phone call as a courtesy, and pretty well treated him shabbily. Here you've got Jackson on his way to Atlanta. Presidential ticket? Well, sure, Mr. Dukakis reserved you one right on the back of the bus. Now this cartoon really interested me because I thought it was pretty evident who I was taking the kick at. I thought the subject matter of this cartoon was pretty evidently not Jesse Jackson, but Michael Dukakis, as having treated Jackson in a fairly shabby and demeaning manner. I got a lot of negative reaction, both phone calls, letters, comments from coworkers about cheap-shotting Jesse Jackson, not Michael Dukakis, but Jesse Jackson. And I suppose it indicates the power of some images nowadays. Apparently, you're just not allowed to use the terms back of the bus or the like for fear of offending certain groups now. That alarms me. It alarms me that people can't sit back and actually look at a cartoon and read through it and pick out the point without jerking their knee up to their chin first. But it was that at least was interesting to me about this cartoon, that I got so much negative reaction. And the point had been totally misunderstood. Jackson raised a stink at the convention, acted kind of haughty for a little while, and ended up being a drag on the Dukakis campaign for a bit. These kind of cartoons are fun. These kind of cartoons are fun because, to me, they are... The essence of what a cartoon ought to be. This is not the world's greatest cartoon, I'll grant you, but it's illustrative of what I think cartoons ought to be, and that is as purely visual as possible. I use some dialogue, and in fact, sometimes I use a lot more than I would like, but I always feel a little let down, a little bit defeated by that. I know nowadays there seems to be a real trend in cartooning toward what I call comic stripping it, where you have several panels or at least a lot of dialogue going on in the cartoon, political cartoon, where you have one character setting up a joke, another character sort of filling it out, and then boom, the punchline's applied. And it's just a lot of words and everything. It's sort of turning editorial cartoons into Johnny Carson monologues, I guess, where you take a political topic and just make a joke about it. To me, a cartoon ought to be a visual image. You've got enough print on the page as it is, and I think the the words tend to diminish the impact you can have with your visual vocabulary. It's a little bit more difficult to come up with an understandable visual cartoon. A lot of times I'll do them and the readers just call and say, what the heck did that mean? You know, because they don't understand the sort of puzzle I piece together. But it's always a lot more fun for me when I'm able to do something with, without quite so much wordiness to it. Having gotten the nomination, number one, I thought Dukakis gave a pretty good speech at the convention and did a good job of consolidating himself. But still, he faced a number of problems in his drive to win the presidency. The first problem is what a lot of folks refer to as the Howard Baker syndrome, where you've got a guy who's basically competent, but when he sits at a podium, you see his eyeballs. That was so short. And in fact, he always had to have his risers behind the podium and stuff. This is a really cheap shot, cheap joke cartoon I did on that problem. Okay, Mike, to increase your stature as a candidate, just stand on your record as a governor. I am standing on it. Another issue, another problem here for Dukakis that the GOP has been able to latch onto to some effect has been his furlough program in Massachusetts, the one that he's signed off on. And George Bush particularly has used that to bash him over the head and distinguish his policies on crime from those of Dukakis. Here you've got an inmate coming to Mike before his selection of Vincent saying, so while I was out under your furlough program, I thought I'd drop in and apply for vice president. I think really when you come right down to it, the biggest problem Mike Dukakis faces is the past. It's the past history, recent past history of the Democratic Party. There are a whole slew of voters out there now who are not taking their political cues from Vietnam, but are taking them from the Carter years and the Iran hostage crisis and inflation and misery index and whatever you want to have. So you still have Dukakis and any Democratic candidate, Walter Mondale, face the same problem, having to live down that memory and that heritage. This is a cartoon that sort of shows the distinction between the two. It's coattail effect in politics. You've got Bush riding along with Reagan and Dukakis being caught up in Jimmy Carter. Honestly, I just drew this cartoon because I wanted to draw Jimmy Carter. I missed the boat on him and didn't really get into it while he was around, so it's always fun to sort of take a gratuitous slap when you get the chance. Moving on from the Democrats to the Republicans, who've also been fun, I guess I ought to preface any remarks I make on the Republicans by saying that although a lot of readers would claim I'm a Republican, I tend to consider myself in more philosophic terms. I don't like to label myself by party, but by philosophy. And right now, I don't see anybody in the Democratic side that really carries my banner. I was fairly sympathetic to a lot of what Reagan had to say, particularly early on in his first term. I think his administration and his presidency has been diminished through the last 3-4 years, particularly. But I will say that I was a big fan of Ronald Reagan. I'm a much less of a fan of George Bush. I don't think that he's got the same agenda as myself. One of his problems, although he benefits from some of the accomplishments of the Reagan administration, one of Bush's problems is having to follow in Reagan's footsteps. He's been overshadowed by Reagan, and when Reagan blunders, it's a blunder for Bush. This was particularly true when Reagan finally came out with a real endorsement for George Bush. It happened at probably the worst time it could have after accusations of astrology came out of the White House. And you got Reagan saying, I'm endorsing George Bush for the most important reason of all. He's a Gemini with Saturn on his cusp. Another problem Bush has faced is the
the so-called wimp factor.
And I kind of sympathized with Bush on this front because he's just been blasted about it left and right. In fact, I have some woman that calls me up every third morning. She's a Greek, and she's a big Dukakis fan, and she calls me up and shouts in my ear, "Why don't you blast the wimp? Blast the wimp!"
He's sitting there drawing, just trying to...
In all honesty, I don't know of any vice president in the world who's not a wimp. It's the nature of the job. You have to sort of supplement everything you are and think and play the lawyer lackey. So here you got Bush in his campaign headquarters, war hero, college athlete, CIA chief. So how come they call me a wimp? The vice presidential petticoat on. We talked about Bush being negatively affected by some of Reagan's gaffes. He's also, as we said, in Reagan's shadow, and this was true right before his acceptance speech at the convention. There was a lot of talk on the part of media types about how was he going to handle this question. We've had the great communicator, for crying out loud, for 8 long years, who can just carry rhetoric to its highest heights, and now George Bush is going to have to get up there and follow this. And it was a problem for him. I thought he did pretty well, but this was a preview of what I thought might happen. Sort of an old vaudeville motif. Doesn't look like a whip to me. One of the first executive decisions, quote unquote, Bush has been called on to make was his choice of vice presidential running mate. And I really don't quite know what his motivation was in picking Quayle. I'm not a Quayle hater like so many people seem to be. I'm not a big Quayle supporter. There are a lot of other people out there that I would like to have seen Bush pick. I think had he made a different selection, he would be 48 states in the bank right now, rather than having to struggle through as he did. I think what probably went through his mind was not overshadowing himself, but at the same time wanting to attract groups that polling found him weak with, women and baby boomers. So you go after a young Robert Redford lookalike, and I hope he can help you out here. Here's Bush at the singles bar, but Dan Quisen, think you can get us some dates? Which is a fairly, it's kind of a strange way to go about things, I thought. And Quayle just got totally annihilated by the media. This is a question on that. My job is to take cheap shots, but even I was amazed at some of the things that were being thrown out about Quayle. And it's probably the one reason, again, why Bush is still struggling. It's funny to me how George Bush has done as well as he's done, actually, without saying anything else. I think George Will had a call about that lately, where he said, the guy hasn't done anything, and yet he was able to make up this huge gap he had against Dukakis in the polls and actually take the lead. He accomplished this primarily by playing off the American flag and Pledge of Allegiance. Here you've got Bush as the flagpole sitter. Cute little pun, B-O-L-L, instead of P-O-L-E. And, hey, Michael, how's the weather down there? And wrapped himself in the flag. And that says something about the depth of our campaign so far. Even though Ronald Reagan has been a master of television, I think this is the first campaign where television has been so evidently intrusive in the process. I've seen some cartoonists, I know Gary Trudeau in Doonesbury recently has been blasting the campaigns for manipulating TV. Now, I think it would be his contention that the TV networks are being used by the campaigners. And that's true in its way. I think it's a circular process, though, and I would put the emphasis on TV dictating the terms of debate nowadays. And that goes back to TV being dictated to by the American public, in fact. The American public has an attention span about the size of my four-week-old. If you look at the publications with the highest circulation, you'll see TV Guide and Reader's Digest, where you don't have to read more than a paragraph to get through a specific thing. So TV is dictating that the candidates operate in sound bites and visuals, things that are easily plugged in to 15-second bites. This is just a little cartoon on that aspect of things, where you've got the election trapped by TV trying to get out. It's been evident through the campaign, during the debates, where you've got everybody trying to come up with great one-liners and punchlines. This is a cartoon I drew right before the first debate. They told it, you two, no props allowed. But the caucus in his little tank ride, Bush in his flag. And then the final sample would be just a reaction to the first presidential debate. Does the soundbite from Mr. Dukakis have a rebuttal to the visual from Vice President Bush? And I hope things change, but I don't see how they possibly can when we have TV being the source of public information nowadays than it is. Anybody have any questions right now before we go on with some doodling and stuff? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Where do you start these? Your cartoons. Do you get an idea and then you just scrub it in the middle and start all over again, or do you futz with them?
Generally, what happens is I've got a stack of about 1,500 legal beds at my desk, and I'll come in the morning and read the papers again, as I said, and then just start doodling. And it's funny how cartoonists work. I know cartoonists that'll sort of set it up like some grand painting. You know, they're great artists and they know what to do here, the composition. I always start with eyeballs. I just start with the eyeballs and work out from there. Honestly, I don't quite know where I'm going sometimes. I'm having to cut out pieces of paper to tape on and extend the drawing out this way or that way. It's kind of a visual free association that I go through most of the time. Very rarely does an idea just pop right into my head. Wholly fabricated. Sometimes those are the best cartoons, the ones that come so easily. I know that I've been disappointed when I worked on a cartoon that took hours and hours and hours and don't get any reaction to it. And some days, like the Ronald Reagan with the little Capitol dome on his nose, you say, oh, what trash. And people, it seems to hit a nerve with people. I've never been able to explain it. But the process is really indefinable. It's hard for me to detail for you. It's sort of an intuitive type of thing.
I think my question was exactly the same, and I was intrigued as I looked at the ball and chain.
Right.
Did you get the idea? Clearly, Jesse is a drag.
Sure.
Did you?
Well, yeah. I mean,
did you?
I'm sorry. I'm interrupting you.
No, really.
I guess
it's the same question, and it's probably unanswerable because it's a mental.
Yeah. What came first, the image or the motif? I think with that particular cartoon, it was fairly straightforward cartoon. I mean, you had every newspaper in America for 3 or 4 days was talking about what's Dukakis going to do with Jesse Jackson, and Jesse's being a drag on the campaign. He's such a radical in so many ways. Blah blah blah. So of course you start thinking that Jesse's a ball and chain. And then as a cartoonist, you say, well, hey, Jesse's head's pretty round. And it's pretty easy to draw a big round ball. And I've only got another 2.5 hours before deadline, so let's go with that. I wish I could be a lot more specific. And if I could, I could bottle it up and have a system every morning where I go in, and it would be that much simpler. But, you know, I, as I said before, every day is a new day, and it works differently from one morning to the next.
Keep one or so in the box so that morning you can come out with it?
Actually, up until the last 4 weeks, none. I loved the terror of walking in the morning and having to, you know, the clock just takes on a face of its own with a scowl looking down at you and starts to go faster. Did you know that? It goes faster as the deadline gets near. And it really does energize you and peps you up some. But since the twins arrived, I've decided it's more prudent to have one or two in the box and be able to. It was much simpler when I first started out. Jimmy Carter was in office. I think I've really got to be doing this full time during the last few years of Carter. And during his administration, and somewhat into the early Reagan years with the recession, it was much simpler to have what are sometimes called evergreen cartoons, cartoons that will never die on the vine. You could draw about inflation, and you could draw about the recession, and you could draw about Khomeini, and you could draw about all these topics that were going to be consistent for months at a stretch and never go away. Nowadays, with the exception of a few things, yeah, I can draw about the deficit if I want to. But other than that, there's not that many topics out there that won't die in a matter of days. Particularly with the campaign going on, everybody's saying something every other day that overshadows what went before.
How much influence do you think the cartoonists have on shooting the boys?
We were discussing this earlier. I really don't know. I think our effect is probably exaggerated. I sound like George Bush now. Over-exaggerated, yeah, a new word. I think it's exaggerated, our influence, because number one, there are not that many newspaper readers that actually turn to the editorial page. Now, I'll grant you the ones that do generally look at the cartoon, but I think what we do, I think the effect we have is cumulative. If, for example, you've got a huge number of cartoonists in America drawing Richard Nixon with a 5 o'clock shadow every other day of the week for 3 years, at some point in time, the reader will begin to associate Nixon with caricature, just as they will Reagan with his caricature, Bush with his, Dukakis or Carter with theirs. So in that respect, we influence debate. Locally, you might have a greater impact on real policy. I know of some cartoonists that have been able to get traffic lights installed at intersections or something because of a very specific cartoon they've done. But when you're talking about national topic, I doubt very seriously that Ronald Reagan walks into the Oval Office and picks up a Bob Gorham cartoon and says, "Well, golly, he's right. We're going to have to change that today." And if he did, I'd be scared for the nation. the silly thing is, here I am. I'm 33 years old. I've got a BA degree at the University of Virginia. Took English and religious studies. Never took a real government course while I was here. Never held public office. Never ran for public office. Wasn't even class secretary in public school. And here I am trying to tell the President of the United States how to, run the nation. It's really a bizarre kind of enterprise when you think about it. I guess what I try to do is reflect the general public and reflect the concerns and cares that go on out there in your average American home. Yes?
Do you concentrate your work on individuals or do you do a social scene, like how the picadillos have been going on Wall Street, or stuff of that nature?
Generally speaking, I like to skip around. Right now, I'm particularly focused on politics. I prefer the name editorial cartoonist, though, because I do deal with social issues, with issues that aren't particularly political in nature. And those are sometimes the most enjoyable and most exciting issues to deal with. Like, as you mentioned, Wall Street. I mean, there are a lot of topics out there that I'm tempted to try and approach with cartoons that are very difficult to do justice to through cartoon. A lot of topics out there are really too complex to be addressed by cartoons. This is a minimalist art form. What you're doing is distilling things down to the very simple, most simple level. And when you're talking about broad social issues, America in decline, quote unquote, for any number of reasons. The educational system, there are so many different aspects to that topic. What you have to do is sort of pick and choose your focus within those broader ranges. and discuss them. But yeah, I like to deal with things that are non-political.
On Sunday mornings, Sylvester Stahl's program usually ends up with a leading cartoon of the week,
mm-hmm.
which is almost devastating in some respects.
Well, I would argue, I know the people at Face the Nation, and I've spoken with their producer about this to a degree. I would argue that Face the Nation doesn't use the most devastating cartoons of the week. In fact, they use what I would consider very mediocre gag cartoons on a lot of occasions. And I'll include my own work in that. The cartoons they use by me are the ones with the least impact and point to them, because they don't want to offend their viewers. The same, I think you could say the same for Newsweek magazine and other broadly circulated publications and newspapers.
You ever read the World Review News? They have a lot of European cartoons.
No, it would be interesting though, because there's a whole different approach and tone to their work. A lot more, or I don't. You could tell me, are they much more scatological in their humor and imagery than we are?
Much more subtle.
Really?
And almost no caption.
Yeah.
Thank you, Aldridge. About 50 years ago, I knew a man named Kerry Orr, who seemed like a very liberal kind of fellow when you talk to him socially, but who wrote vitriolic anti-FDR cartoons mm-hmm. for the front page of the Chicago Tribune.
Right.
I asked him about that, and he said, well, that's, in my job, you do with the editor what the publisher says. If you write for a Republican paper, you write Republican cartoons, and vice versa. Now, 50 years is a big change, but I wonder, is there any, in the field at all, are there any, is there any pressure on any of the cartoonists, either through direct or indirect pressure, to slant the subject matter of the cartoons in a way which is either consistent with publishers' point of view?
There is that to a degree. There's one cartoonist I know of in a very similar circumstance that was applying for a job, and he was asked what his philosophy of political philosophy was, and he looked at the editor who was doing the interview and said, my philosophy is whatever my publisher wants it to be. And there's another story, it might be apocryphal, of a cartoonist, younger cartoons, that suddenly was starting to be reprinted, and people started noticing that he was saying exactly the opposite of what he had been. I think he had been doing some fairly conservative cartoons, and then all of a sudden he was advocating huge government outlays and domestics and welfare spending and cutting back on defense and all these other things that weren't really in line with what he said before. He was asked about it and he said, yeah, well, I found out that conservative stuff just didn't sell. Which is it's a very cynical attitude. Now, there's no one answer to your question. It varies from newspaper to newspaper. The degree of pressure which is placed on a cartoonist is ultimately up to that cartoonist publisher. It depends on his publisher's personality. I would argue that if you're in a situation where you're constantly at war with your newspaper's philosophy, then you're in the wrong place. And you're actually prostituting yourself to a degree. Everybody's got to eat, everybody's got to have a job, and we all compromise to some degree. But I know of one cartoonist who worked at a newspaper that endorsed Ronald Reagan for president in '84. And his editors, for some reason, allowed him to draw a cartoon that had Uncle Sam or somebody, I guess the cartoonist himself perhaps, in a box. The cartoon was in a box directly beside the endorsement, and it was facing toward the endorsement, thumbing his nose at it, and sticking his tongue out. Now, there are a lot of issues where you can disagree, but that's a pretty fundamental disagreement. Because if you're saying that you would rather have Walter Mondale as president than Ronald Reagan, that indicates to me that you've got an entirely different worldview than your page. And if you're going to be true to yourself and true to your readers, you ought to move on somewhere else. I'm very, very fortunate. Because number one, because I, as I said earlier, I work at a page that likes to have a voice. And number two, I work for a publisher and an editor that having hired people who are philosophically compatible allow them creative freedom and allow them
a loose rein. I can count on one finger the times I've had a cartoon axed. And that was for reasons of libel more than philosophy. It was a legitimate concern that, you know, we might cost the paper millions of dollars if this thing ran, and I'd kill it too where I'm in their position. But I've never had my editor or publisher come to me and say, draw about this, say this, or you can't say this. Now, I know for a fact there are certain things I couldn't and shouldn't say on our page, but I never say them because I don't believe them. And I was hired with that in mind. So I'm very comfortable. You'd have to speak to other cartoonists about their own situations. Yes, ma'am.
I was interested in the graphic quality of some of the cartoons, mm-hmm. I wondered if these were ever available on printed on good paper.
Well, these things, I don't consider this great art.
I'm thinking of Hogarth and Crookshank, right, kind of cartoons that are...
I draw these things on a fairly heavy ply Bristol board that's specially treated. It's called Unishade paper. It's got a chemical in it, and you brush on this clear chemical, and you can get some sort of gray halftone to come up. It's just a shortcut for reproduction. But I've never had any real high-quality prints. Once they're drawn in the paper, they're done for the day. They're done for the year, for all eternity. They're
too ephemeral to keep.
Right. Yeah. At least to me. And I've got boxes of them stacked up. In fact, I shipped some off to my old high school to the store for them. And I really don't have too much use for them. The only reason I would see to keep them, and the only reason I do keep them, is if at some point I get a wild hair and really want to put together a collection, but I don't ever see that happening. That to me is a fairly vain enterprise. You're sitting here and you're saying, I've arrived as a cartoonist, here's my work for the world. So, my work's in the newspapers. If anybody wants to go see it, they can look it up.
When did you begin? Greensboro, were you being?
Oh, yeah, at age three, drawing Lone Ranger and crayons. I really got serious about it while I was here, really. And all through high school, I was going to be the great American novelist and rewrite Moby Dick and all that other neat stuff. And I came here, and I'd been to Virginia Episcopal School in Lynchburg, which was at the time all male. And I got here and walked up on the first floor of Dunnington, and lo and behold, there were women walking around. And it was a whole new world, and I found out that editing and re-editing and stuff, the writing just took so much time away from my social life. I couldn't compete in the literary world anymore. So I'd always been interested in doodling and cartooning and sort of started going down this road more and more. And this became really enjoyable to me because of the immediacy of response. You didn't have to wait. You drew the cartoon, it ran in the Cavalier Daily on it or whatever. Somebody came up and said, hey, I saw your cartoon. That positive reinforcement just snowballed and got me more and more interested in this. And then I freelanced some at the Daily Progress, and from there just kept. Here, I'm going to have to stand now. I'm sorry if I get in somebody's way. Don't quite think I can do it from the sitting down position. Start with Ronald Reagan, just because he's fun. And Ronald Reagan is great because he's got this really neat look in his eyes, especially nowadays. He's not really totally vacant, but I was so dismayed when he went to Moscow and signed up with Russians and stuff, and he was in Red Square, and somebody asked him about all this great rhetoric from years past. What about the evil empire? What about this? And he says, oh, that was a different time, a different era. I mean, it's like yesterday they were bad, and now they're wonderful. So he said, I don't think he's quite as sharp as he had been. So I give him these kind of vacant little eyes, sort of like that. I always start with the eyes. And he's got a little new potato nose. Comes out. Got some wrinkles. Then take off the capital, give him a little scar. And then you just start putting in some folds and stuff. You
you've got this great big lip that comes down. It's real goofy. A little shadow. Another wrinkle down there. Some more wrinkles. And somebody asked me what this is. I don't know what this is. It's either his lip or his chin. I've never really decided. He's got these real ruddy cheekbones. And more wrinkles. Come down here like this. And Ronald Reagan's really neat, because if you've ever watched him, he's overcome a great, horrendous birth defect. He was born with eyebrows that don't work in conjunction with each other. One's always up, one's always down. And if you ever see him on TV, you'll just notice. You're going to reach out there and get one in synchronization. But to really get the Reagan look, I found you got a one up and one down. And then the fun starts, because you just kind of give him that. I like to put in some highlights and some reflections. Whatever it is he uses up there. And his ears are sort of affected by age and gravity, so they... His shirt collar, for some reason, is always too big. And he wears, his taste in clothes is just incredible to me. Because I saw him go to some economic summit in Europe, and here was the representative of our nation, the leader of the free world, was wearing this sport coat that looked like a couch my wife and I bought at Sears. Had this great... kind of Borea pattern in it. TV cameras couldn't ever really focus on it. It's kind of faded in and out. And that's Ronald Reagan. Which has gotten more.
Yeah.
Try the presidential contenders real quick. Use this smaller pen. Bush is fun, even though I've never really captured him. I hadn't gotten him yet. But he's fun because he's so, his face is like his whole personality is just frenetic, you know. He's just got he's just a jumble of angles and everything. He's sort of like Reagan with his eyes, but a little bit wilder. And he gets all excited. His nose is real sharp and pointy, and then his lip just. Goes everywhere. He's got this little chin. Comes out. He wears these little glasses. He's been wearing his glasses a little less. I like to put them on just because they give him some character. And then his hair is never really combed because it's all angles. A lot of sharp angles to it. So he's got those little wrinkles in his forehead from worrying about something. And we can put him in the American flag, I guess. So. That would be George Bush. And then Michael Dukakis is really the most enjoyable of the two candidates because he's got such classic eyebrows. Never, not since Leonid Brezhnev
just the eyebrows to match these things. And then he has 20 little eyes. He got a great nose. Very serious all the time. His hair is always perfect. It's like he hermetically sealed it with something. It's got a solid glaze over it. Which is sort of in keeping with his personality. If you saw him on TV, you notice that he doesn't have any shoulders. We'll draw him actual size. Yeah. And that's Michael Dukakis. Any other questions?
How long do you study somebody? You had to do this cold with Robin or Buddy or Ansley or Florence.
I'd run out the front door.
That would wait.
Now, generally, a lot of different things are involved in being a good cartoonist, and we all have our strengths and weaknesses. It's my belief that my caricature is probably one of the weaker aspects of the cartoon. A lot of cartoonists are just sensational caricatures and really capture the features and the personality. I've got to struggle at it. It's very difficult. The best process I've found for even coming close is to study photographs, watch them on TV, because then you get the movement and the gesture. And the caucus is always getting this and this. Then put it all away and just let it gestate. And eventually, one or two features will drop out onto the page as you're drawing them. And you work from that and just kind of evolve it as you go along. What I really rely on is consistency. I don't think my Ronald Reagan really catches Ronald Reagan as well as a lot of cartoonists do. But my readers know he's my Ronald Reagan. So I don't have to slap a label that says, this is Ronald Reagan on his chest every time I draw him anymore. And the same for Bush and Dukakis and whoever. You just kind of hope that they catch on, and I hardly ever get calls saying, who is that guy? So I guess they're passable, but I would say that they're probably the weakest part of my work.
Do you ever change them very much?
Yeah, I change Reagan quite a bit. They're always quite a bit. They're evolving all the time. And if whoever we get as president next, if you look at the first few cartoons I do of them and compare them with the work I'll do 4 years later, you probably won't even see much similarity between the faces at all. It's fun because presidents change in office.
Yeah, they changed.
Jimmy Carter was great. If you had Jimmy Carter as the candidate.
Changed the side, he parted his hair.
You never, he squinted up and he smiled. He had that lip stretched out like that, mm-hmm. And the teeth. Do these real quick, but it really is kind of great to see how they change, And as he had his hair going that way when he was elected, but he was the populist, agrarian, I'll never lie to you, Jimmy Carter, and he's covered up his ears, hair was down to his ears, getting that windblown look. He always had that loose tie. I'll never lie to you.
Trust me.
That sort of thing. Trust me. I'm not one of that Watergate bunch. That sort of thing. But Jimmy Carter, when he was running for office, was more like that. When he got to be president and had inflation and Ayatollah and everything hitting him at once, he got this big old look like a rabbit in the middle of the road, I guess.
when your headlights hit it. And he lost weight. And he didn't smile anymore. It's like somebody took a pin and just popped a balloon because everything sank. And when it sank, you could see his upper lip, and it just looked awful. And it was a big old anchovy up there. And he lost weight. He was a marathon runner and hunted killer rabbits and stuff. And he had these waddles. And he had to wear a coat and tie because he was president now. And who was Jerry Rafshoon, I guess, was his image man. He dressed him up in suits with the collar buttoned up. And he got a haircut, which was fine, but it was a bad one. And they left white walls, nubs on the side. And it turned out that when he cut his hair, there's always the expression, lower in your ears when you get a haircut, and that's what happened with him. It really sank down. Turned out they had these huge ears. It was just... That's a pretty radical change.
Anybody else have a question?
Well, thank y'all for having me. I appreciate it.